doers, mowing season is here. With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, you can get gas like power with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower for just $329. With a runtime of nearly an hour, it's the perfect mower to tackle your half-acre lawn without a trip to the gas station. Just push and mow. Your grass won't wait, so buy it online and pick it up in-store to get out there sooner. Get gas like power this spring with the Ryobi 40-volt push mower, just $329 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sports Creative Fantasy Football Podcast. My name is Davis Maddock. I am joined today by Colin Drew. We are under a week for the NFL season actually starting. We're recording this on Friday. The NFL season starts with Leonard Fournette ruining the first showdown slate of the year on Thursday. And we all got to get our brains back in NFL mode because playing NFL DFS, it's a little bit more of an art than a science. You definitely need to be massaging things. You need to be adjusting on the fly. And honestly, just as much for us as for you guys, we are just going to kind of work through some strategy stuff for NFL DFS for the upcoming season. We're going to go over some of the tools that we have in the optimizer on Daily Roto, but also just, you know, kind of just more general strategy stuff.
Yeah. And if you've been buying apes and punks, you've got huge bankrolls for the season. So definitely got to put those to good use. If you haven't, then you're like Davis and I, we got to grind, man. All these other people are going to make $250,000 selling JPEGs of apes with neon colors and grills. But we're here. We got to grind with the people to make our bread.
We do. We got to grind. We got to be in there in the streets. And we'll be doing more GPP specific stuff on the show this year than last year, because we are going to add a GPP element to the Gilcast this year. We're going to do the people were very much opposed to the elimination of the cash game lineup stuff. So we're going to do that as normal. We're going to be tilting all of that as normal. And then we're all going to enter in the red zone, which I think is the $50 single entry on DK. And we're going to keep track of profit, loss, and standings between the three of us there. And we'll be talking about, you know, what we did that was right, what we did that was wrong, and how unlucky we are to not be rich.
Yeah. And I know we've got a bunch of free and premium content over the next week. Next week, we'll have a big free showdown strategy podcast with you, me, and Brian Jester from Occupy Fantasy. So today we're going to be going through the main slate, basically talk MME a little bit, how to use optimizer tools, talk process, but also talk some of the differences in contest types and single entry 3-max. And, you know, I think really thinking about contests as far as like what contests are filled with DFS regs versus casual players, I think goes a long way towards separating how you may want to approach those different types of contests.
Yeah. And I guess the first place to start with is goals, right? And strategy, like very macro strategy, which is like, what contests are you entering and why?
Yeah.
So, and I've done both. I've done load up an MME and make, you know, 300 double stacks with double bringbacks. I've done the single entry stuff, had literally no success in MME for NFL. And part of that is that I literally really only did it for a year. And that, you know, the contest sizes are so insane.
It's just whatever.
It's just whatever. And that just was like so frustrating for me, like to like just not have sweats and to just see the red line go down. And so last year I switched it up and I did not MME at all other than for showdown and was just doing the $100 single entry, the $50 single entry on DraftKings and on FanDuel. The FanDuel has a really good $40 single entry. We don't talk about FanDuel that much because people are more interested in DK content for whatever reason, but that is a good contest. And it's just, you know, it's easier to realize your equity. You know, some of those contests, you only have to beat like 850 other people to bonk or whatever. And that is a strategy that suited me much better because I still tend to play things relatively close to the projections. Like I'm not going into MME week one and, you know, stacking some shit bum team, like with 1% ownerships, like it just, it's not what I'm particularly good at.
Yeah. And I think a lot of those points make sense. Definitely having your playbook as far as what contests and then overall an approach towards each of those specific contests is a good way to level set. And for me, what I'm going to do to start the year, and I'll plan to stick with it depending if I bonk, but I'm planning to MME on FanDuel and only on FanDuel. And the only exception to that would be possibly early slate on DraftKings or short slate on DraftKings. But yeah. I think that FanDuel in general goes undercovered in content because a lot of the industry does talk DraftKings, partially because they have access to the contest CSVs. So it's a little bit easy to articulate some content around that. But I think because of that, some of the spots and the nuances to FanDuel go a little bit uncovered on a week-to-week basis, in addition to just macro strategy. They also have a cheaper price point. So you can usually MME 150 set in a big lottery style contest for $450 or $600. Whereas on DK, a lot of times that might cost you $3K or something. So I like the DraftKings single entry three max formats a lot. They've got a lot of them. So you can get like 20 different, 30 different teams.
You can build yeah. 5 teams, 10 teams, 20 teams, and put them in contests where you are realizing your equity more. And something I've done getting lazy is just making one main team and entering that in the 100, in the 50, in the 12, in the 5, right? And I think I will not be doing that this year. I will be making different teams.
Those are kind of the contests I'll plan on attacking: smaller field stuff on DK, the MME stuff on FanDuel. And then I'd diversify through the three maxes, even if it's just like a 2v2 pivot, just to give a little bit more exposure there. And yeah, I don't know. It worked well last year. It was half a yard away from $1 million on FanDuel, but hopefully we'll get that half yard this year. And then obviously Showdown is definitely where I degen a little bit more MME there. So I don't know. I feel pretty good. It's all pretty easy to manage from a workflow perspective. And hopefully we'll have some tidbits we can share as we go through different buckets on the show.
Yeah. So I think probably the best and most proper tools to be constantly thinking about as you are, if you are doing MME, and this is even true for other GPP formats as well, but the things you have to weigh, and this is like very rudimentary, is like projected ownership, projected points, and what that delta is. And we call that delta leverage, which is, you know, chance that a player ends up in the optimal lineup and, you know, the percentage that player is rostered. And that's like very basic and very elementary. And it also is not like one size fits all. And that's where, you know, the art versus the science comes in. It's like sometimes a negative leverage play is actually like the right play due to the context of the slate, right? Like week one.
Or your roster overall, for sure. And that stuff, Andrew Barron, Hot Magic, who works with us, he's behind the scenes right now cranking through all that. So we'll have the leverage tools integrated into the optimizer this year. So you'll be able to see those probabilities of a player landing on the optimal lineup right next to the ownership. You'll even be able to optimize off that. And like you said, you know, if you've got extremely low probability, high leverage options in a stack, like it's probably fine to take the negative leverage running back in that context. But those will help you frame that decision and also optimize off that if you choose, or build groups to, you know, try to avoid too much bad chalk or good chalk in the same lineups.
Yeah. And like, you know, I'm kind of thinking about this like a poker book or something, right? Where they like lay out these scenarios to you. And it's kind of similar where like you can solve for the situation like holistically, not using the exact example. So like the poker workbook for this would be like Mike Davis for the Carolina Panthers, right? That first week he was 4K. No matter what his ownership percentage was, he was the right play, both before lock and after lock. And the ways to create good, unique rosters after that were like play Derrick Henry on DraftKings over Alvin Kamara, right? Or play Tyreek Hill instead of Devontae Adams. That's actually a classic one that will repeat itself 10 times this season on the Sunday main slate, where Devontae Adams will project as insane chalk and project for like 1.5 more PPR points than Tyreek Hill, and Tyreek Hill will be half the ownership. Like it's that is like a color by numbers, like very easy DFS example.
Yeah, definitely. And it, like you said, is the context of the overall lineup and trying to make sure that each lineup is plus EV more than the individual players. And there are other levels of that too, just with correlations. And I want to talk more when we get into specific contests, but, you know, bring back stacks and things like that in certain types of contests, like those interact with leverage calculations in a different way as well. So a lot of different layers too, but a lot of that, you know, starts out, I think, with the foundation that both of us are operating from a principle that holding all else equal, we want to correlate our lineups as much as possible, both within stacking with the quarterbacks, secondary pieces of those lineups, as well as the overall game environments.
Yeah. So this is true both anecdotally and in like mining contest results. So for me, my best team last year was a Dak Prescott double stack with Jarvis Landry and Odell Beckham. That insane Browns Cowboys game. That was my best team. That was my biggest score last season. Paid for my entire NFL season, which is something going into the season that I was like, I'm going to consciously do this. I'm going to play semi suboptimal plays to get the results that I want, which is the double stack with the quarterback and the double bring back. And that is basically the most frustrating way to build teams, because you're going to be playing suboptimal plays at other spots because of the salary constraints. And, you know, NFL games are predictable, but they're, you know, they're just all sorts of things can happen in the middle of a game to make it go haywire. But by and large, I think it is kind of just accepted at this point that the combination of projected points and leverage is best spent in, you know, high total, high passing attempt games with double stacks and two players from the opposing team.
Definitely. And I posted some data in the subscriber Slack that we have, like games with totals above 50 last year. 25% of those had five or more players in that game, putting up 20 plus points on DraftKings. And like 40% of those had three players at the flex position. So, you know, some of those could just be full on onslaughts, like a QB triple stack. Mahomes triple stacked definitely came through a couple times last year, but a lot of those are bring back situations and just getting exposure to that overall game environment when it does go back and forth. There's some pretty interesting learnings in there when to get down to like the team level as well. I guess one of the caveats I'd say is I think the double stack, bring it back, like I've been talking about it for 3 years, at least, if not four, and we've got content on the site up from that long ago, but it has become more pervasive in different circles. And it's become more of a part of everyday, I guess, podcast shows. And so I actually think it's got to a point where it still makes a ton of sense in lower stake stuff, in large field stuff, but I actually think in reg filled contests that people are starting to bring it back maybe a little bit too frequently. And I wanted some of your feedback initially on that take. And then I'll walk through like a specific example last year and see what you think.
So my thoughts are that actually in those contests that you're talking about, the spy, the red zone, even like the Thunderdome and stuff, because an 80th percentile result can result in a winning score because the point requirements are not as high, the overstacking might actually give you better results because you can have like a burned roster spot. Like you can have a $3,000 wide receiver who gives you 4 points or whatever in a winning lineup in those contests. Whereas in the lottos, right, in the Millie Maker, the Mini Max, you know, you're up against 100,000 other entries. I think that you could even galaxy brain it out and say, actually, I might even want to be playing uncorrelated lineups there, because in all likelihood, the optimal lineup, the truly like the perfect lineup or whatever, is more likely to be uncorrelated. That probably would just be the highest scoring player at every position, whether or not they played on the same team.
Yeah. I think if you look at the data, shout out to Leonie, they did a podcast. It showed that the top like 100 lineups in the Millionaire Maker were still double stacked with the bring back to a higher percentage than the field is doing. So even in the lottos, it seems like that strategy was underutilized. One of the examples I wanted to walk through from last year was the Chiefs Jets game, because it was a game where Jamison Crowder was going to be out and Denzel Mims, Braxton Berrios were both close to minimum priced. The Chiefs obviously had a 28 plus point team total there. And in that game, Mahomes threw for 5 touchdowns, but the punt receivers basically laid an egg. And in normal contest, I would like the lottery style ones, like 20, 30% of the field brought it back with a jet. in the 3-max, like 153 max or the $400 juke, it was 80 to 90% of the field that were bringing it back. And so all right. of those lineups basically took not a zero, but a 10 point score, used up one of the valuable wide receiver spots, extremely high ceiling position. And just a simple thing like the Mahomes triple stack instead of the double stack would have shipped all the money. But even just finding a subtle pivot at that flex wide receiver position off of Berrios or Mims changed the roster construction and overall allowed you to gain a lot of points in the field. So do you feel like 80, 90% bringing it back? Like that seems pretty crazy, right?
Certainly 80 to 90% is overstating the amount of time that those guys would be required in a winning lineup. Even if you knew going into this late, okay, Mahomes throws for 350 yards and 5 touchdowns, 90% of the time you don't have one of Crowder, Berrios, Mims recording a score that makes it into something resembling an optimal lineup. So that is too high. Yeah.
Yeah. So I that's something I'm planning to keep a close eye on this year. If we get into some like week one slate examples, there's like one or two guys where I think that type of context could happen. And I think that could happen on a weekly basis. And so, especially when you're playing against people who don't consume content, then that's different. But when you're playing against people who are actively thinking about a lot of this, I think that is another level that I'm planning to think about this year.
Yeah. So I also think that helps to be team specific. So like the Jets last year, awful team to do the bring back, right? Because they just sucked and they ran the ball too much. The Texans seem like a team like that this year, where like the team against them is going to have this giant team total every week. And how many times is Nico Collins or Brandon Cooks going to end up being a bring back? Like that would actually be a spot where I would be comfortable going like, okay, I'm going to do Trevor Lawrence, Laviska Shenault, and DJ Shark, but I'm going to not use a Texans player. And maybe I would do the correlations in a different way. Like maybe I would correlate a wide receiver and a tight end from a different game while they were playing that week, and do the correlation that way and not have it attached to a quarterback.
So within an optimizer, when you're going through, you know, there's a lot of different settings out there depending which optimizer platform you use, but most of them involve some variation of stacking, right? You can select number of players with a quarterback, maybe number of players from the opposing team with a quarterback, or you can go through and create individual groups. Why don't you just talk to the people at home? Are you going through and creating groups for every quarterback with bringbacks? Are you using key boosts or are you using vanilla rules?
No, I'm using. So when I was doing MME, I created every group by hand. So our optimizer has a way to force in the stacks without doing all that extra manual work, where you can go, okay, every quarterback is going to have two of his teammates and one teammate from the opposing team, which if you're like crushed for time or you're just doing the mini max and you're just trying to play around, I think is fine. Like, I don't think that's bad. But what I was doing was okay, like Kyler Murray, I want him to have two pass catchers and a bring back. But like Lamar, I probably only want one of his teammates. Josh Allen, I would want two of his teammates. There are some quarterbacks who you literally do not want stacked. Cam Newton was that guy last year, where Cam Newton put up a bunch of QB1 scores and had 8 passing touchdowns this whole season. The best ball bros are not going to want to hear this. I think Trey Lance might be one of those guys where Trey Lance can like comfortably get 25 points on DraftKings and not have any pass catcher on his team over 20, like pretty easily. So I think he might be one of those guys. So that's why I make the rules by hand. I last year wanted some exposure to Cam Newton in some of those slates, and this year, you know, Trey Lance, I think would be one of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I'm making all of them by hand as well, and then either using groups or a key boost to account for the correlation on the bring back. So you could force a bring back for every quarterback, or you could just set it up in the optimizer and say, hey, when you're using, you know, Lamar, I want to boost the projections for receivers on the other team by 15% and just let the optimizer kind of ride there. I would also add, I think that's one of the reasons I was successful on FanDuel and MME was not forcing bring backs necessarily. Correlation generally matters more on DraftKings.
The correlation is much weaker on FanDuel also, because of the lack of bonuses.
It also matters a lot more when pricing is really tight. And I would say just generally DraftKings pricing is a little bit tighter. So FanDuel, half PPR, less bonuses, softer pricing. I think you still want correlations because it matters, but you don't have to force them to the same degree.
Yeah, Yeah, no, I think that is accurate. And I guess, you know, this is, no one wants to hear this, but for single entry and three max stuff, I'm very much playing it by case, like Lamar, probably I would just do one of Marquise Brown or Mark Andrews, but like, so with Lamar, you would maybe only want one stack, but the double bring back, right? So like Ravens versus Steelers or whatever, and you think it sets up for a good, you want Lamar to be your single entry guy. You could get away with playing Mark Andrews and then Juju and Claypool as like the double bring back, but only the single stack.
Yeah. And I did some analysis last off season. It was pretty helpful going into last season. And so I did it again this off season and just trying to evaluate which types of quarterbacks you should be looking to double stack versus which types you should potentially look to single stack. Cause especially with like the rise of mobile quarterbacks, I think like understanding the archetype of the quarterbacks is important for creating a bunch of your rules. Lamar was definitely one of the most challenging guys to figure out regardless of which site you were playing on. Cause it wasn't just that Lamar, I mean, he had high upside himself. It wasn't like, and it's all through, not all through the legs, but a lot of it is, but he also had like a pretty broad target distribution where Marquise Brown and Mark Andrews were like the guys you could kind of trust at different points in the season. But for the most part, his big games were scattered. So like he had 10, 20 plus point fantasy games, but nobody else on those weeks had more than two. So you didn't really know what you were going to get when you stacked Lamar. I think he ended up being like, despite a great season for fantasy, he ended up having kind of like low utility from a DFS perspective as it relates to stacking.
As it relates to stacking, because, you know, so like that's like
if he wins QB by 5 points, but you don't get to win wide receiver by 40 points, like that's not quite as cool. Like when Mahomes goes nuclear and Tyreek or Kelsey hangs like 50 at a position, like that's just so much more valuable.
Yeah. And it's not that you like, it's not that like Lamar wouldn't make the optimal constructs. It's just that you'd be less likely to hit the wide receiver scores that you needed. Yeah. Whereas like, I mean, the guy I anticipate myself throwing the most dollar bills at this year is probably Matt Stafford. Like it just looks like he's set up to just go completely nuclear and no one cares about the player takes. Like, I just think Stafford is set up to crush.
Yeah.
He will add almost nothing with his rushing and their target tree should be very narrow. He would be a guy that I would plan on double stacking always. Yeah.
I think that's definitely right. I could walk through some other team examples, but probably the most interesting ones to think about going into the season. And these were some of our favorite teams to talk about on our shows weekly, but Minnesota Vikings and the Tennessee Titans, because both Cousins and Tannehill had big ceilings last year. They were both generally underowned on the average week, as a lot of the field, if they were 10 point favorites or 14 point favorites, usually not 14, but 7 to 10, you would see those weeks where Dalvin Cook or Derrick Henry were going to be the highest owned running back. And so you could pivot off of the chalk running back onto the passing game stack and just hope that the other team was able to keep the game script a little bit more competitive. Cousins actually was one of the best QBs to stack because it was always going to Jefferson and Thielen. And Tannehill was kind of the same way. Like it was usually AJ Brown, but Corey Davis had a little bit of a breakout season. And then you had some tight end games mixed in there. But I think as you're looking at slates, one of the things you should actively be doing on a week-to-week basis is if there is a high-priced running back that's in a great spot, you need to give a hard look to the passing game for tournament considerations that week.
Yeah. So that is, I mean, that is a pretty key point, is like figuring out where the quarterbacks sit in relation to their running backs. So a good example this year is going to be Sam Darnold and the Panthers wide receivers, right? Because we have McCaffrey back in the pool. McCaffrey most weeks is going to be the most expensive, the highest projected, the most owned player at the position, especially if there's like, oh, a jam 3K wide receiver this week, a jam 4K running back this week, then it's going to set up very well for McCaffrey to be in those lineups. And Darnold, you know, adds a little bit with his legs. They have that really condensed passing tree. He would be a really good example. Let's think like the Giants, right? If Saquon Barkley is healthy, he would be Daniel Jones, Kenny Galladay, Darius Slayton, Sterling Shepard, those guys, you know, slates where the running backs are very highly projected. The team has a relatively, maybe even just like a fine total, like 24, 25. Those are great single entry free max leverage spots for tournaments.
Yeah, definitely. And then the other piece that I'm thinking about this year, I didn't really do it last year. The analysis in the offseason showed that I should have, and then I just kind of ignored it because I was pretty set on double stacking with pass catchers. And especially if I was pivoting off of like a chalk running back onto the pass catchers. But with Tennessee and Minnesota specifically, Derrick Henry actually went off in the games that Tannehill went off. So a lot of those games were games that shot out back and forth, and 57% of Tannehill's ceiling games, Derrick Henry also put up 20 plus points. Dalvin Cook did the same thing in 60% of Cousins' big games. Some of that is easier to reconcile with Cook because he is involved in the passing game. He can still get, you know, 6 to 8 targets depending on the week. But I was pretty surprised with Henry. It is the second straight year that it's happened though. And so I think one of the things I'll be thinking about in larger fields or the lower dollar, you know, three max where it's a bigger field size, is trying to mix in some of those onslaughts where you're getting 3 or 4 guys from the same offense.
And you can do it on narrow offenses. And it's actually true that Henry and Tannehill positively correlate, because when the Titans win, when the Titans like get the fantasy numbers, they all tend to do it, right? Like AJ Brown, Derrick Henry, Corey Davis, Tannehill, Firkser, like all get there in a game.
Yeah. So that was one of the things I'm thinking through. And then I think the other thing is some of the when you have an alpha wide receiver like Davante Adams, DeAndre Hopkins, like when you're playing those guys, like whether or not you're going to single or double stack the quarterbacks, or do you just avoid the quarterback? Because if it's all going to one receiver, then you can find like a different roster construction and still get, you know, 60% of the passing offense.
If I am playing a quarterback who gets,
you're going to single stack Kyler this year, would you single stack Rodgers?
No, I would never single stack Rodgers. I would never single stack Kirk Cousins. I would never single stack Matt Stafford. Any quarterback who can get 30, any quarterback who can get 30 with zero rushing production, with 0 points via rushing or via receiving, the scenario, like Davante Adams, I actually think we're going to look back at his 2020 season as like this crazy outlier where they basically used him as the goal line back. Like I anticipate him scoring something more like 10 or 11 touchdowns this season, which like that's how he's projected. But like Everyone kind of in their minds is like, that's bullshit. He's scoring 15. Yeah, like
they think 10 or 11 over the course of the season sounds good. But then like if he doesn't score in a given week, people are going to riot.
Right, exactly. And so, and again, very micro, but like, you know, the beats are all talking about how good Marquez Valdes-Scantling looks. Tonyan scored all these touchdowns last year. Tonyan actually a great example of like why you should just be throwing darts on random secondary guys. If I recall correctly, he had a 3-touchdown game when it wasn't really clear that he was a thing yet. Like he had been playing, but didn't have a huge receiving role. Demarcus Robinson has done this with the Chiefs. Mahomes had a 4-touchdown game against the Raiders in 2019 where Tyreek and Kelsey didn't score. Right. And like, sure, that literally happens once every 2 years for the Chiefs where that element happens. But in the occasion where that does happen, you have a 1% owned Demarcus Robinson and you have all this leverage on, you know, Kelsey tends to be super popular on DraftKings specifically, a little bit less so on FanDuel, but Kelsey tends to be super popular on most GPP slate. Like he's generally the most owned tight end on the average DK slate. And you're just getting all this leverage off of Kelsey teams.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And then I think the other place potential opportunity I saw when looking through the stacking data from last year is, it's can be frustrating for season long. It can be frustrating for DFS as well, but finding offenses and passing offenses to stack when there are multiple receiving options, because over the course of a season, the offenses of the Pittsburgh Steelers, Cincinnati Bengals, and San Francisco 49ers may distribute the ball pretty evenly between the three primary targets in each of those offenses. But in the individual game, a lot of times you're going to still see two of those guys take 55-60% of the targets. And because of the distribution, a lot of those players will be projected similarly coming in. I think the ceiling on those guys is all pretty high. The ownership usually gets depressed a little bit. And so I think coming into this year, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and San Francisco are three of the offenses that I want to attack in larger field tournaments.
Yeah, just, and this is something you can mine from like seasonal fantasy football data, is like when a team has all these wide receivers going really close to each other in ADP, that will kind of semi-reflect how the DFS market will think about it. And I actually can even give an example for week one. I feel very confident in the fact that Marvin Jones is going to be the Jacksonville Jaguars chalk wide receiver.
Definitely.
He is 3,600. That's already a spot. They're playing against the Texans. Shark is 5,800. Laviska Shenault is 5,000. Like, I would imagine Marvin Jones will be close to the highest owned. I mean, maybe Elijah Moore also. James Crowder is COVID, so maybe not going to play in week one. But like, that is just an obvious spot where you play the two guys who are more expensive you could probably get overweight on Laviska if you played him at like 12% of your teams or whatever. And because people are not certain how that will shake out. Also attacking the rookies earlier in the year. So like, and this is even a week one leverage spot, right? Everyone's going to play Elijah Moore against Carolina, but are people going to play Terrace Marshall Jr. against the Jets? Like, probably he'll be half as owned as Elijah Moore. Like, people have literally been tweeting about Elijah Moore as a play since pricing came out a month ago.
Yeah, there was definitely some possibility he wasn't going to end up popular if Crowder was active, because I think it's pretty easy to sell yourself a story of an ease into the offense for a rookie. But if Crowder ends up inactive due to COVID, then I think all bets are off. You're likely going to see, you know, chalk in week one. I think earlier in the season, it's always going to gravitate towards two or three guys at each position, because there will be some guys that emerge as clear values based on training camp reports and the pricing structure. And I think those are definitely going to be some of the guys that you'll have to wade through this year. I'd say Marquez Callaway probably is another interesting decision for week one, because I do think he'll be one of the other highest owned guys with, you know, Michael Thomas out, Jameis at quarterback, and then what Callaway did in the one half that he played with Jameis during the last preseason game.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the point I just wanted to illustrate as a whole is that specifically with the elite quarterback teams, right? So, you know, Rodgers, Brady, Mahomes, even Josh Allen, there just is value in double stacking and including the cheap guys who could get a zero on any given week, but also like just because of the quarterback they play with. And you are, by playing the quarterback, you're already saying, I think this guy can have 404. Yeah.
Yeah. The Bills, another great example, right? Like we know that Allen and Diggs, right? That one of the highest correlation stacks you could find last year, but I don't think it's immediately clear whether or not Cole Beasley, Manny Sanders, Gabe Davis will, you know, be the secondary target. Was Beasley last year, but off-season stuff there a little bit. And I don't think we know what the rotations will look like. And so it's going to be hard to project one of those guys as a clear wide receiver too, despite the fact that like they'll definitely have that upside during week one of the NFL season.
Yeah. What are chalk spots that intuitively you try to work away from?
So
you go first.
Yeah. I mean, I think the easiest one is probably like for years is working away from the chalk wide receiver or the chalk tight end, because a lot of times the opportunities are limited. Usually they're, if it's a alpha chalk, it's like an 8 to 12 target guy with 1 to 2 red zone targets a week. If it's a value chalk, it might be a 6 target guy whose median stat line is like 6 to 60.
The value wide receiver chalk is the one that I have no problem fading. Like Marvin Jones week one, if I get burnt by Marvin Jones week one, so be it. Like here lies Davis. He was buried by Marvin Jones scoring 4 touchdowns on 5 targets or whatever. Those are, and also it's about the quality of the pivot. Like if there's one obvious lineup construction for single entry or 3 max for a given week. So like there's one cheap running back fill in, right? Like running back X fills in for running back Y who got injured. Then, you know, Alvin Kamara is not on the slate and Christian McCaffrey is, and there everyone is playing Zach Ertz at tight end or whatever. And then there's also one $4,700 wide receiver that projects to be 5% more owned than every other wide receiver under 5,000. That's like the most obvious spot to like, you can play these other plays that are highly owned and then move off there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other spot that I tried to actively work in, because every week the simulations that Andrew Barron does over at Daily Roto would show that running backs are typically going over rostered, at least as far as it relates to their optimal lineup percentage, which I would just caveat that's intended for the lottery style tournaments, the largest field tournaments where you really do need close to the optimal. And so I think trying to work away from the running back chalk is something I actively tried to do a little bit more last year. That's why I tried to pivot sometimes in those same games to the passing game stacks and just capture the touchdown variance. But I think the easy and the right answer is definitely like the wide receivers and tight ends, value wide receivers and tight ends. And DST too.
Oh yeah. Never play the most high owned defense. I don't like, they could be playing a Pop Warner team. Just like it's the most obvious and most variant spot. Like if there's ever a chalk $2,800 defense, that's like actually a spot to maybe enter in more fees that week, like at more contests. If you ever think a defense is going to be that owned, because if that defense gets two and you pick some other random defense that gets 10.
Yeah. Or you like, happen to stumble on the 18 from someone.
It's huge. I will say I very rarely fight back against the 50% owned backup running back. Like it's a pretty rare situation where I'm like, yeah, I'm not playing Sony Michel filling in for Daryl Henderson this week. I'm not playing Damien Williams filling in for David Montgomery. It's like extremely rare for me.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the areas where the content in the industry is over geared towards DraftKings a little bit. A lot of times the backs who do end up popping there are maybe guys who are going to get workload in both the passing game and the rushing game. On FanDuel, like touchdowns definitely matter more. And usually these guys aren't entering into 28 point team total spots. And so I think it's a little bit easier there where like you're going to need your backs to score two touchdowns. And it's a lot easier to sell yourself a story on the guy failing to do that than maybe it is on him if he's really getting like a 22 touch workload on DK, including a passing game role. So another reason where MME on FanDuel, I think, is a pretty interesting consideration.
Yeah. And actually, by the way, I think fading the chalky running back is like, it's not good on DK to me in general, but it's like terrible bad on FanDuel. Like you get guys who are,
I guess like at the end of the day, there's always an ownership level where you should be willing to consider fading somebody, right?
Okay. The week Taysom Hill was a tight end on FanDuel.
So what? I think our analysis showed he should have been like 60% owned and he was only going to be like 55%. So it was like,
well, he was higher than that. Oh, maybe. He ended up being higher, but I didn't, I played.
Did my you cash. Lock him?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I locked him because I thought he should be 100% owned.
Yeah.
I thought that the correct ownership number for him, and I didn't even MME on FanDuel last year, but I MME'd that week just because I like, if 8% of people faded him and he got 20, he got 26 that week or whatever. Yeah. I mean, he outscored every other tight end by 10 points. I actually saw that as a spot where the game theory bros were going to over Galbrain themselves. And like, this happens in college football DFS too, where there'll be like a quarterback who's preseason DFS. We just had this example 3 weeks ago. Nathan Peterman was the only quarterback on the slate who was going to play all four quarters. And he had played all four quarters the week before. We knew he was playing all four quarters. And still, because the game theory bros are game theorying, he was only about like 60% owned in contests. And he outscored every other quarterback by like 7, I think. And that was a spot where I was like, I was sitting there making my team like, should I even try to do this? Like, should I even try to Galbrain off of him? And I was like, no, I'm just going to do it. And I view the backup running backs on FanDuel very similarly on DK, because those guys can get game scripted out. Like it happened to Alexander Mattison last year, right? Dalvin Cook missed one game. He got game scripted out. I think he got like 6. And that hurts more on DraftKings than it does on FanDuel, the way the scoring shakes out. But I just think it's bad most of the time.
Yeah, that's fair. Two places, I guess two of the other GPP talking points that felt like were important. I guess they're both associated with late swap, but one is late swap that occurs after the contests are locked. The other, I guess I would call it late swap. Like most people are building their lineups before Sunday at 11:30 in the morning. They might update them afterwards, but a lot of people have built lineups by that point. Inactives come out. I do think, especially in these lower stakes contests, that if it is truly a surprise inactive, a surprise situation, like when Tony Pollard got the start last year, when Zeke was a late surprise inactive, those situations are still going under rostered. If it's a situation where there's been like a week of buildup into a potential inactive and all the content's been around it, then those are ending up pretty popular. So I think in the low stakes stuff, if it is truly a surprise situation, you're paying attention, you should react pretty aggressively to that news. In higher stakes, people are going to pay attention. They're adjusting to that stuff.
And I can even give an example of that where I was planning on a late game inactive and it ended up working out for me. And my team would have been dust if it didn't work out. Like I would have dusted off my $100 entry or whatever. But Chris Carson, game time decision week 8 for the Seattle Seahawks last year. And Carlos Hyde was already out. Travis Homer was banged up. So DJ Dallas was the only running back that they could play. He was 4K. Chris Carson was a true game time decision. He ends up not playing. It was against the 49ers. DJ Dallas scores 2 touchdowns in that game, ends up being, you know, in the nuts. You needed him. And that is an element that people are just not willing to do. I mean, people don't use late swap enough as it is, especially on their teams that are dead. I actually feel like that's well-worn territory at the time, but you don't very often hear on tout shows people talking about actually having a really suboptimal team at lock waiting for the late injury news, like planning on it and not really having a backup plan.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's in a way, it's almost like playing with position in poker too. And just even like a tiebreaker should go to a 4 p.m. guy over a 1 p.m. guy anyways, if you're really torn between like a one-off on the spot, because yeah, you have this additional news about how your roster stands. If you're first place, this is your last guy, you can just truly, truly play the best play and leave them in there. Whereas if you need to make up ground a little bit, you start to understand what that looks like, how it relates to min cash lines versus the first place lines. And so I definitely think some takeaways I had from last season were, especially in low stakes MME, to react aggressively to late news. And then across all contests to try to build with some late swap strategy built into the lineup ahead of time.
Yeah. Which is like that. If you are having questions coming into the season, or just largely wanting to try to be a little bit better or expand your game, I would start thinking about late swap this year as like something you want to use a little bit more strategically. Because a lot of the questions people ask are like, how do I do my correlations? How much should I be stacking? But like that is and it's, I mean, I can't even imagine trying to set up all these swaps for MME. Like it's a nightmare. I have done it and it's incredibly difficult, but if you're just doing the single entry, three max route, it's much easier to master.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. All right. Are we good? Do we have any other strategy stuff that we want to talk about?
Oh, I mean, I think that's a pretty good, kind of a pretty good blueprint for thinking about the season. Definitely trying to be active about how I'm approaching which contests, separating that into contests that are filled with more casual players versus DFS regs, and then trying to correlate those accordingly. So we do got a promo code. If you guys want to use the tools over at Daily Roto, you can enter the promo NFL21 for 10% off. But like we talked about, we'll have the optimizers, range of outcomes projections, floor and ceiling projections, the probabilities of each player to land in the optimal lineup, projected ownership and leverage scores on top of all the content that we do. So there's plenty of stuff there to get your feet wet.
Yeah. All right, everyone. It's going to be a great season. Gilcast is coming back. Colin Showdown shows are coming back. We are going to have a new program on the show, on the podcast feed this year, that we'll be able to tell you guys a little bit more about next week. And yeah, I wish you all the luck in your final best balls. And we'll see you back next week.
With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.